This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to HRN on Tour. This is Christine Sykes-Lowe, and today I find myself in the kitchen of Mr. Bill Smith, Chef Bill Smith. I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and we are visiting today. Bill really doesn't need a lot of introduction, but just to go down the line, Bill Smith is the author of 2 cookbooks, Seasoned in the South and Crabs and Oysters, and has many articles and essays in various magazines and journals. In 2019, he actually retired after 25 years as the head chef of Crook's Corners Restaurant in Chapel Hill. And he has received many nominations several times from the James Beard Foundation for Best Chef of the Southeast and has served for 6 years on the board of the Southern Foodways Alliance. And actually, in 2021, he received the Craig Claiborne Lifetime Achievement Award from that organization. It is really great to see you again.
Really, yeah.
And I feel very cozy and at home in your house.
Well, thank
it's
you.
Colorful and filled with art. And
yeah.
I really, really appreciate you welcoming here.
Oh,
and I just kind of wanted to kind of go down, like we talked about a little bit before I came here about how you've been retired officially since January 2019. So what have you been up to since then?
All right. Well, in January of 2019, my last day at work was the Crook's Corner Book Prize, which is a literary thing that Crook's Corner gave every year to a new Southern writer, first novel about the South, set in the South, blah, blah, blah. And so it was sort of like there's a little wingding they would throw. The winner would be invited to Chapel Hill, and then all the people on the board and people in the publishing business around here and all that kind of stuff, they'd all come. So that was my last night. That was great. So like the next morning, I got on the plane for Mexico City because I was also turning 70 in a few days. I thought, you need to get out of town. You know what I mean? Between, you know, retiring and turning 70. Yeah, somebody will do something if you don't. So I went to Mexico for a while. And then
when you say I went to Mexico for a while, you can't skip over that. How long were you there for?
Okay, well, I was there for a month. Which is, I have, my staff is from, a lot of those guys were from all over Mexico. So I have friends all over Mexico. I would go visit them when they've gone back home or I've met their families. And so I was in Oaxaca, and then I was in Mexico City, and then I was in Guanajuato in the north. So I was all over. I just hop on a bus and start going when I get down there. Fly into Mexico City and then decide which way I'm going to go. And it's really fun. And I love this guy so much. And so I just took my time. And, you know, Mexico is so inexpensive. It was like, you know, free almost. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so I did that. And then I came back and I did a bunch of fundraisers. You always have to do all these events when you're a chef, particularly if you have some notoriety or whatever. And also for publicity purposes, you're sort of required to. So in the all these years at Crook's, I met all these people and made all these connections, and so I'm often asked to do things. And so we did fundraisers. We did one for an immigration organization in Raleigh, and there's a museum down on Harkers Island that was badly damaged in a hurricane. We did a big cookout for them to raise money to help them get up and running again. And then what else? I don't know. I was in Asheville for Chow Chow, and then I was in Palmetto Bluff for Music to Your Mouth, and then I was in Atlanta for Oyster South, which is a fundraiser for independent fishermen.
And I tried to, and I we were going to work together, but a hurricane derailed our plan. That's for right. Pinehurst.
It was that year, too. It was 19, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
But we knew each other before that, too.
Yes, we did.
From Highlands. Was that?
It was actually the first time we got together. I think we knew each other before this, but it was for the Oyster Cook-Off in Alabama.
Oh, yes. Okay.
The Alabama Oyster Cook-Off.
I meet so many people, I can't remember why. And I see a face, and I think, okay, I know that person. And they look like they know me, and why do I know them? And oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That was fun. I love Johnny Fisher. I love these people.
Yeah, it was fun. We had that oyster panel, and we got to judge what kind of oysters were the best.
I wish they'd asked me back. I loved that.
Hey, oysters are never a bad time, right?
Right.
So
anyway, that was stuff like that. I can't remember all of it, but yeah.
You've been busy. I mean, the reality was you were a busy man to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, you worked very long hours. You were at On Demand. You know, you're a writer. You also obviously ran Crook's Corners, but you were also an advocate. And part of that developed, if you could go into a little bit more about how your advocacy for immigrants started.
Okay. Well, like I said, a lot of my staff were guys from Mexico. And in the 90s in North Carolina, there was nobody to work. And the guys started showing up from Mexico to work. And everybody thought, oh, this is the best thing that's ever happened. These people are great. Don't you have a brother? Could call your cousin, blah, blah, blah. So, and then when 9/11 came, there was a switch. And people began to see foreigners as devils, right? And it got worse and worse and worse. And then in 2016, it really went to hell. And I just had, by that time, a lot of these people had worked for me for almost, 15, 20 years, these families. And I just thought, well, you have to run interference for them any way you can. One of the first things it occurred to me to do was they had children born here who were American citizens. So I wanted to make sure all their stuff was in order. We got them. We made sure we had all the birth certificates and baptismal records. And then I did a fundraiser to get all their passports. We got, I think I had 17 kids from people in my kitchen. And then people were so generous that we fanned out, and I was able to do Cliff's Meat Market and some people down at the brewery. And we had enough money to spread out. We didn't just have to do our kitchen.
Right.
And so, but I don't know. It was really horrible because they were saying terrible things about these people, and they were just like, well, what's going on? I thought you liked us. It was awful. It was horrible. So the last thing I did, and I'm knock on wood, I never had to use this, but I took custody of all those children. There's a thing in North Carolina, I can't remember what it's called, but in a sense, essentially it's like if something happens to the parents, I could step in before social services got the children. And I thought, please don't, and it never did, thank God. So, but anyway, I don't worry about anything. I haven't worried about anything in years, and I was worried to death all the time, and I hated it. It was just awful. But
I mean, these children, these families literally became like family to you.
They were your
grandchildren. Yes. I'm looking, I'm in his kitchen and I'm seeing his refrigerator covered in photos and hand-drawn art from the children. And yeah, near and dear and very close to your heart.
Yeah. And I wasn't trying to be like a, any kind of hero or anything. It just saying, what am I supposed to do?
Well, that's what felt right. Right. No, it's what felt right. You've been working with these people forever.
I'm sorry. I don't care where people come from, frankly, or what color they are, or what church they go to, or any of those things. Don't make any difference to me whatsoever. There are two countries in the world. There's one with jerks and one people who try not to be jerks, right? That's the end of the story as far as I'm concerned. So, anyway, you have to decide you don't care if you get in trouble. I didn't, happily, but I could have, I guess. And
yeah.
You have to just make that decision and then just do. Well, and then when the pandemic came, everybody got thrown out of work. And so then nobody could pay rent or anything. So I did another fundraiser, blah, blah, blah. And people again were really generous, and we pulled everybody through that because a lot of them weren't eligible for any kind of public assistance. And those who were had been told by you-know-who that people that had green cards that took public assistance were in danger of losing their status. So even people who were entitled to it were scared to do it. So
yeah,
get me started. I've already gotten started.
Well, let's segue to Mexico general. Mexico, because you started some food tours to the region and kind of tell what you have planned or what you've done in the past and what you have planned
going
forward.
Well, this is new,
forward.
Actually. There's a bar down Rosemary Street from here, behind Crook's Corners, called Bo Bar. And one of the owners is a woman named Amanda Barr. And her mother, Jane Robinson, like 35 years ago, sort of semi-inherited, semi-bought a hotel in downtown Oaxaca from an aunt. And she just moved there, and she's been running this hotel. It's beautiful. It's like, it's little, and it's you know, all the rooms open out to the central garden. It's a typical Latin American setup. Anyway, so I've gotten to know Jane over the years just because she comes back and forth. And I when I go to Oaxaca, I always stay there and stuff. And she was up here last year. And she said, you know, why don't we do a food tour? And I said, okay. And we use the hotel as a base. And she's, like I said, she's lived there for 30 years. So she knows weavers and potters and mezcal makers. And she knows all the restaurants and all this kind of stuff. And it's a pretty, you know, beautiful city. And people are so nice there. And so we said, okay, well, let's do one. And so I sort of put on Facebook, who is interested in this? And we got like 1,000, you know, so.
Big so, response.
Yeah, right. So we ended up having to do two. So we did two 10-day tours in January. And Jane, she's my age too. So, and she's another old hippie. And so she said, okay, we're going to do this. But if anybody's all whiny, we're not going to do it anymore. But everybody wasn't whiny. It was really fun. So we're doing two more in August. So
this coming August, and are there spots available?
We haven't even set up the date yet. Oh, okay. She's going to be here in a couple of weeks because her grandson's here. She's coming up for his birthday, and we're going to plot then, and then we'll just make the announcement and, you know, duck and see what happens.
So how do people, just if there's someone listening, how would they find the information on this?
Watch on Facebook is all I've ever done. I mean, I don't think I need to do anything else.
Yeah, you have a pretty good internal crowd.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, I actually spent some time in Mexico, I think it was around October. Uh-huh. And it was my first time I really spent any significant time there. I was near Bucyrus and Sayulita.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
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 What were you doing? Just...
It was just a little rest away.
I know. I had a friend
who had she was Canadian, and uh-huh. She invited me to come stay, and it was lovely.
You just have to do a sit. It's crazy.
And
it's
it was relaxing. Yeah. But it wasn't even about like what you would think of as, you know, the resortish kind of. It was just very lovely, and everyone was so friendly.
No, everybody's lovely there. It's a,
yeah.
And a lot of times when I go, there's a city in the state of Guanajuato called Celaya, which is where the bulk of my original staff came from. And it's not, I mean, there's no beach or no ruins or anything there. It's just a big, it's like going to Greensboro or something. You know, it's nothing wrong with Greensboro, but it's not a tourist destination, right? But I go there and I just hang out, you know.
Have a friend. We're going to have some Greensboro people mad.
No. I just said there's nothing wrong with Greensboro. Maybe it is a tourist destination.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. But I don't know. I live so nearby, it doesn't occur to me to go look. Maybe I should change my tune. Anyway, but the point is that it's just like a regular town, you know.
Yeah.
And I have lots of friends there, and we just hang out and drink beer, you know, and don't do anything. I
mean, yeah, and just it's hang really, out.
And, no, yeah. We're just the best friends, and I can't think of anything I'd rather do. I've never been to the beach in Mexico, actually, now that I think about it, because none of my friends live near the ocean.
Yeah,
because Oaxaca's up in the mountains. You know, there is a beach in that state, but I didn't go down there, and I go to Mexico City a lot, and that's right in the middle of the country.
And that's such a cultural destination.
Oh, my God.
With art.
There's a bazillion museums there. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I just love that place.
Well,
sorry.
So I definitely think that I want to talk about something that maybe you don't talk about a lot, but it has always interested me, is uh-huh. that you were one of the original founders of the Cat's Cradle.
Right.
In 1969.
69 is when Marsha Wilson, who was the actual foundress, as it were, she was the one who got a little money when her father died. And her brother, Stevie, was sort of well-known in the club scene in the West Village in New York at the time. And she loved that music and stuff, but didn't want to start another club there. So friends told her to come look at College Towns in the South. So she went to Charlottesville, she came here. And she ran into people that she liked here and just said, okay, here. So, so anyway, when we were realizing we were approaching 50 years, we were going, okay. And of course, I couldn't remember when we did it. It was like, we were, I mean, I sort of knew when we did it. I knew when we probably did it. But so I can't remember which one it was. One of our city council members went through the records and found the first business license. And it was September of 2019. So, and we were in a basement, on Rosemary Street, this little tiny basement on Rosemary Street. And then a few years later, we moved down the street to a building that we shared with Dip's Country Kitchen. And I was involved until 1984. And then I was starting to cook, I guess. And And then Frank Heath bought it in the next couple of years from David Robert, who had come in after Marcia, well, before Marcia died, but actually came in and sort of floated it because we were horrible business people. I can't even tell you. It's a wonder it lasted 5 minutes. Anyway, David kept it going, and then Frank bought it. And then in 2019, we had 2 weeks of big parties, and all these bands came back from all over, and people came from all over the country, and it was just fabulous.
Well, to those listening who aren't familiar with some of the Chapel Hill icons, obviously Crook's Corners is one of them, and Cat's Cradle.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely is one
of them. It's actually in Carrboro now, but we call it Chapelboro because it's two towns. But
it's a little merging.
No, music is a huge deal here. You know, it's like there are publishing houses, there are producers, there are recording studios, all kinds of bands, you know, come and go from here. Everybody wants to play here now. And, you know, it's like a cottage industry. I dare say it produces quite a lot of tax money for the local governments at this point. You know, and all kinds of talented people, and people come here because of it. I have many friends who came here because they had heard of Chapel Hill music and they were interested in music, and they were musicians themselves. And ended up coming here to live. So,
but you're, I know, knowing you, you're also a huge indie music fan.
Yeah,
you support that. And during the pandemic, a lot of live music venues were suffering, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Did, in fact,
there were some fundraisers and things to keep it going with online events.
Frank was really good at that, Frank Heath. He did a whole bunch. They have really good tech over there. And so they were sort of set up to do live streams. And they did lots of them. They did all kinds of things. And one good thing about it was that they did a lot of people that couldn't fill the big room, but who were good musicians, but nobody knew them. So all these people that we didn't really know, or we'd heard tell of, or who was an opening act, but you couldn't get over there in time, had little shows online the whole time. And it was really great. And there was a woman, what's her name? She's in Durham, and she has something called Carolina Wave, and it's all hip-hop. And I had met her, but I can't think of her name. She was so fabulous. She did a series of shows that were out of this world. You know, I never would have seen any of that stuff, probably. And then They did an online album called Cover Charge, and a lot of the bands that were fond of the Cradle all did covers of songs they liked, and that all the money from that went to the Cradle, and that was a huge success. Apparently, that helped them a lot. And when these online events, you just on Venmo or whatever, just pledge $5 a night, you know, or whatever you could afford to that night, and some of the money went to the band, and some of it went to the Cradle, and so they just sort of slug through somehow, you know.
And as many venues did, some did not survive.
We were lucky here. The Cave made it. 506 made it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is amazing. But this is a music town. People here sort of rose to the occasion, you know.
So I would love to kind of ask you, do you have any more books in the works? Do you have anything that...
So I don't know, like everyone else, I kept hitting these motivation walls during the lockdown. My first thought was, oh yeah, I've got. If you saw my office, that's at least two cookbooks sitting in those piles on the thing. You know, I've got the stuff there; it's all written out. But I would just run out of steam. I also was thinking about a memoir about my staff, and I started on that a long time ago. I'm sorry, I started on that a long time ago, but the situation kept changing. It kept getting less and less entertaining and funny, and more serious. And so, I have many essays about my staff and working with people from Mexico and going to see them in Mexico and stuff. And I'd like to throw that together into something, but I don't, my agent publicist has retired, and I'm 73 years old. I don't have the energy or the interest, honestly, in starting a new relationship. So I've got to figure out how to do this. Maybe self-publish. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do, but yes.
That would be an interesting cookbook, the stories that you have based on your time in the kitchen there with your friends and family, so
yes.
to speak.
There's lots of angles. Lately I've been thinking about maybe hiring. I've done this before and it worked out good for me. Just hiring a freelance editor to sit here. Tell me what you think in a week, you know, and just, you know, give me some direction. And that's helped me before to get stuff done. So
when we were planning to work together for the Pinehurst event, and it got canceled because of the hurricane.
Which is the one that wrecked that museum, I think.
It was just, it was a very unexpected, unfortunate thing.
Right, yeah.
But I remember when you submitted the menu, that damn pie.
Yes.
Was on the menu.
I can't go anywhere without it now.
Okay, so for a little bit of background, so this is a pie What's the original recipe? How did it develop? How did
okay,
it come
well,
about?
Okay, well, I'm not sure how it... I have an idea that there's
and Bill calls it that damn pie.
I call it or that stupid pie sometimes. It depends. It's I made up the name Atlantic Beach Pie because I had to name it something, you know, to put it on a menu the first time I did it, right? So and Atlantic Beach is a town down the road from where I grew up, where we would go in the summer, and there are restaurants there that serve this pie. So anyway, I'm guessing it has something to do with lack of electricity and refrigeration, because you use condensed milk and eggs and butter that don't have to be refrigerated. Well, people didn't used to refrigerate them. They do now, but once upon a time, they were always sitting out, you know, and then canned milk. And everybody had a stove, so you could cook. And I guess you had to eat it right away or something. I don't know. But anyway, so it was just one of those things that all the little seafood restaurants out on the beach had some version of this pie. And it always had cracker crumb crust. And then it was like a key lime-ish sort of filling, right? And we grew up with it. And it was really good. And we always looked forward to it. And then I didn't think about it for 40 years. I moved away from the coast. I came up here to live and, you know, rarely got home and all this stuff. And the Southern Foodways Alliance was coming to Eastern North Carolina for a field trip one summer. And it's known for barbecue down there. But they asked me, because I'm from down there, if I would do one dinner that wasn't barbecue. And I said, yeah, cool. And Sam and Cindy McGann from the Blue Point up in Duck were in on it with me. And I was thinking, I remember that pie, it was so good, we loved so much. So I got some church cookbooks and I called around and I found there's a bunch of different versions of it. So the day that I made it, and this is crucial, I had saltine crackers at my house. So that's what I used. That is
crucial.
No, but that is also a source of conflict, which I'll tell you. Oh. So anyway, so I made it. I just played around, got a recipe that seemed to work, made it with saltine crackers, and it was really good. Oh, this is great. Okay. So I made it for the event, and that was 10 years ago, maybe not even that long ago. excuse me. And I thought, God, this is really good. And it's really easy. I wish I remember this years ago. So I'm going to put it on the menu at Crooks, right? So, okay, right. So I did that. And then, who was it? Katie Workman, the cookbook writer, came to dinner. And she was a friend of friends. She had friends here in town. And she said, oh my God, this is fabulous. And so then she told her friend Melissa Gray, who's a producer at NPR. And so they did a piece on it on the news. Well, that was the end. I mean, they went. But and it also had been in Our State magazine, I think, about the same time.
And in Southern Living and New York Times.
That was yet to come. This yes. Was the, but yes, it was in everything. But so anyway, then it just went nuts. And so, but then I started to get blowback. And it was like, down here, we use Ritz crackers. We don't use saltine crackers. This is people down on the coast. And well, it turns out that's not entirely true. There's Ritz crackers, Captain's wafers, saltine crackers, or oyster crackers. I've since discovered. So anyway, so this is, and then I didn't put meringue on it because in a restaurant, you know, meringue shrinks after a day, right? So it sweats, and so it's not practical. But so I was using whipped cream. So then it was like, I got these, it was in the Charlotte Observer actually. Are you throwing out those egg whites? You know, are you wasting all that food? You know, why didn't you leave well enough alone? It was fine like it was, blah, blah, blah. So this went on for a while, and finally terminated when this museum fundraiser, that I was talking about earlier, what started it was I was challenged by the cooks of Harker's Island to put my pie against theirs, and Harker's Island is down on the coast.
Oh,
so they did the salt, the Ritz cracker crust with meringue, and I did my version of it. And because we were ladies and gentlemen, so we said it was a tie. But anyway, I mean, it was fun, but it was like, and like I said, it's inescapable at this point. If you pull it up on Google, you get 10 pages, you know. So
and literally just about every publication, any kind of food list or publication.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So will you ever get tired of making it?
I don't know. I made one for you.
You did. He made one for me.
And actually, this fundraiser I'm doing in a few weeks, they actually wanted banana pudding. And I was shocked. And I was glad because that's easier. I mean, I can make a big pan of it. I don't have to do a million pies. So this is a first. Maybe it's finally run its course. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's flattering that people like it. People, restaurants all over everywhere call me and say, do you care if we do that? And I don't know. Take it away. You know,
have at it.
Yeah, please. Better you than me. It's like, but no, I don't know. It's sort of funny and amusing. At least it's easy. I've had to make 10 million of them. So
yeah.
It's one of the easiest things you can do. So
well, we're getting ready to taste some.
Yes,
and I tell you, this has been a treat, being welcomed into Bill's home and seeing his life and getting to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, not at all. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Yeah.
I forgot we went back all the way to Alabama like that.
Yeah. And there might have been some Southern Foodways Alliance something before even that. So it's great to see you again. And thanks for listening to HRN on Tour. You can find all of our programming at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.